Hello, it's Robert Bathurst here. I was one of the first guests on My Time Capsule, and Mike has asked me to tell you that you can now listen to the podcast ad-free by subscribing to Acast Plus. Details of how to join are in the description of each episode. Mike says it's very reasonably priced. In fact, Mike says it's a bargain. And who am I to disagree, locked here in his cellar? Anyway, for a small subscription, Acast Plus, My Time Capsule, ad-free. Free. Unlike me.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello, and welcome to My Time Capsule. I'm Mike Fenton-Stevens, and in this podcast, I talk to my guest about the five things from their life that they would like to preserve in a time capsule. They choose four things that they cherish and one thing that they loathe and would like to get rid of, something they like to bury in the ground and never have to think about again. My guest in this episode is, I'm delighted to say, one of my oldest acting friends, Paul Bradley. Paul and I first met whilst recording a children's sketch show series for Granada Television in the mid-1980s and went on to record the Kate Robbins show for ITV with the wonderful Kate Robbins and her brother Ted, who's also wonderful. I went on to eventually make a podcast while Paul became Nigel in EastEnders for 6 years and then the wonderful Elliot Hope in Holby City for 10 years. He's also appeared in My Family, Doctors, Bottom, Red Dwarf and The Young Ones, amongst other things. He was in the multi-award-winning film The Pianist in 2002, and since his first days as an actor at the Manchester Royal Exchange, more of that in the podcast, Paul has been in a large number of plays over the years. He's also the lead vocalist and guitarist and sellotape player in the group The Kippers, spelt H-K-I-P-P-E-R-S. Yes, you see, the H is silent. And maybe that sort of sums him up, really. He's very funny, often very silly, self-deprecating, and yet deeply serious about the things that matter. Paul famously visited Rwanda for comic relief, shortly after the terrible genocide in that country. Again, more of that in the podcast. So let's get straight to it and listen to Paul Bradley tell us the five things from his life he'd like to put into a time capsule.
My first thing to go into the time capsule is a review I got. My first review. And I haven't even got it. But what it was I had a fantastic English teacher at school. Mm. And he happened to be an Irish English teacher. And tragically, he was murdered. His name was Philip Lawrence. Do you remember the case? He was he went on to be headmaster of a school in
Maida
Vale, and he was stabbed to death.
Oh my God!
He was an amazing man, really amazing man, really inspiring. And at the time that, and I include you in this, at the time that we started in the business, or started thinking about it, it was never any, you know, your parents would have going, what, no. And your school said, what, no, you can't do that. And he gave me this review. I did a short George Bernard Shaw farce, and he wrote this review, and it just encouraged me. And it was the seed of that encouragement which led me to sort of think, well, perhaps I have got a little talent. And, you know, if I work and dedicate myself to it, perhaps it might work out. So my first thing going in would be that little review, because even though I don't have it, it could be found because it was in the school journal. But included in that is, because I sort of, when I was thinking about this, I thought, well, if I was a young actor, what advice would I listen to for people who've sort of coming to the end of their careers, you know?
Or maybe reached it.
The other thing is, so encouragement and then support. And my family, even though I remember when I got my first job, first properly paid professional job at the Royal Exchange in Manchester.
What a great job.
Yeah, it was brilliant. And I phoned up my dad and I said, I've got my first professional job. And he said, fantastic. So are you going to settle down and buy a house? And I said, no, because I'm out of work in 6 weeks' time. And he went, what? They've given you a job and sacked you. So he didn't understand. And this time last year in lockdown, I came back to the Royal Exchange, and it was a fantastic play. It was about the slave trade in Britain. I played Turner. It was an amazing play written by Winsome Pinnock, who was the first black woman to have a play put on at the National Theatre. And it was this time last year, in fact, it was St. Patrick's Day that we were supposed to open, and the director came in and said, I'm really sorry, we can't open. And so I had all that, those fantastic memories of starting my career at that theatre, and I've always wanted to work there again. And I got back there, and it's silly things that drive you on, but when you go around the theatre there, it's got pictures of old productions, and I just thought, I want to be on that wall, you know. And I was playing a small part when I first started. Actually, what was really weird is that I was on the stage crew. And all the stage crew there used to do a piss take of the production that was going on. And I was in it, and people really loved what I did and came up to me afterwards and said that was brilliant and things like that. And then this one actor said to a director that he'd been offered a part to, I can't do it, but ask Paul, because he was brilliant at that piss take thing.
Wow.
And not only him, but people wrote to theatres for me because they thought, here's this bloke on the crew. And anyway, the director said, let's just go upstairs and we'll read the part. And I read it and she said, that's great. And as we were going upstairs, I said, this play that's on at the moment, there's a lot of characters that I could play. And I said to her, I've started understudying them. And she said, oh, that's brilliant. Anyway, next day, I come into the crew. I'm still on the crew.
Yeah.
I come in early to set up the show for the schoolmistress, it was called, and I get paged. Now, at that time, I don't know whether you ever did it, but I signed on, and I was working at the Exchange as well.
Of course I didn't. How dare you suggest such a thing?
But because it was a part-time job, I sort of thought, well, if I come off this, I've got to re-sign on and all that sort of stuff again. Anyway, so they used to pay you in cash. And so for signing on, I was Paul Bradley. But at the Royal Exchange, I was Yanis Lazaridis.
What a career he's had.
So when I got paged, I thought, oh, my God, they've caught up with me. And they said, are you Yanis Lazaridis? But he was a bloke who actually existed. he was a mate of mine. Anyway, so I got really worried and I got taken up to the office. And the director said, you told me that you were understudying some of the parts in The Schoolmistress. Have you understudied this part? And I went, no. And she said, oh, well, that's a shame because the actor's off. Could you take over? So I said, give me an hour. I took the script, literally locked myself in the toilet because it was the quietest place there, and learned it. I came in, we did two walkthroughs of it in the morning. I went on for the matinee and then in the evening, and I ended up staying on for 4 weeks.
Brilliant.
That's as well as doing the other play. So that was a sort of start, you know. That's how I started.
But I can understand how you'd fall in love with that. See, I remember being in Manchester with you, and we were working in the television, you know. So
we were drinking in the television.
We were drinking and doing the occasional working in the television thing, whatever it was. And we went to see Tim McInerney and Trevor Cooper at the Royal Exchange. And I remember I to this day remember your excitement at going into the building.
Yeah.
We went out afterwards for a Chinese meal with them, and you told one of your interminable stories where you you hadn't quite worked out what the punchline was going to be.
Wasn't Tim McInerney really good? I remember he read the lyrics to a song, and it was only supposed to be two lines, but he did the whole thing.
It was brilliant, wasn't it?
It was brilliantly funny. But he used to be known as the three actors who worked the most, Tim, Mick and Ernie. Yeah.
The great thing is about Tim is he's got one of those careers where he's either astonishingly successful or nothing, absolutely nothing. I mean, I've sat and chatted to him and he will say, I haven't done anything for 18 months, nothing.
Blimey. But you've always worked, Michael.
I've always worked, but I'm the sort of person who only ever does one episode of something and then I move on to something else. I think people find me out very quickly.
But does that... No, not true. But have you ever been up for long-running things?
I never have, no.
But Benidorm, you've done a few of.
That's the one thing that I've done over a number of series. You know,
is that what you'd call a returning character?
A returning character, rather than a regular.
Yeah.
When you did EastEnders, I remember at the time thinking, wow, that's a long time to be in something. And then you went into Holby City.
Yes, and I was in there even longer. Mm. But I had real angst about whether I should go into EastEnders. And in fact, my next... So I've done one which is encouragement and support. That goes into the...
Yeah, and it's sad, it's tragic that it is connected to such an extraordinary man. I remember at the time when Philip Lawrence was killed, all the reports from everybody from the school were saying what an extraordinary teacher he was and what an amazing man he was.
He was incredible, yeah.
It's lovely that you can, in a way, reiterate that, because people always think of the tragedy, whereas in fact this is a man who brought encouragement to so many kids.
I tell you what he did as well. He started my love of Shakespeare, really, because he was reading this line and he said, what was it, something, something in this sad knot. And he said, what does that mean? And immediately I said, he sat like this. And he went, exactly.
Wow.
And what it is people forget sometimes that he wrote them to be acted.
Yeah.
So little lines like that.
This sad knot is a man with his arms clenched and folded in front of him.
That's right, this sad knot. And it's a great description of somebody.
Isn't it just?
And the thing about Shakespeare is that I think as human beings, we need to feel that we're connected and that maybe the things that I feel, other people feel. And he can put his finger on it. I remember there was a line, and I was going to include this in my thing not to... but when I went to Rwanda for Comic Relief, it was one of the most devastating things I've ever done in my life. Mm. And I remember one of the things that was very important for the survivors of the genocide was that they could tell their stories. So I remember you'd get up and you'd meet somebody new and you'd go, please, after a while, you'd go, I don't want to hear your story.
I can't hear it again.
Because it was so absolutely inhuman, but it was very important for people to be able to put in words their experience. And clearly, otherwise, people would go, well, it didn't really happen, did it? And I found when I was out there, there was a Shakespeare quote that kept coming to me, the worst is not as long as we can say this is the worst. And it's sort of like if you put a bar and say, this is terrible, then there's always going to be something worse. Mm. And that sort of appreciation for Shakespeare is what Philip Lawrence gave me. And it's a lifelong thing, you know. You find yourselves in situations and you go, well, you know, sometimes you hear a line in watching a Shakespeare and you go, oh, my God, yeah, that's exactly right, you know.
Yeah. I remember you going off to Rwanda. And I remember at the time thinking, oh, my word, this will absolutely change your life.
Yes, it did. And if it hadn't, and I wasn't really going to get onto it because it's terribly heavy, but if it hadn't been for a woman who was there, she worked for Oxfam. She was an incredible woman. She lost, I think, 15 members of her family. She watched her husband being shot at a roadblock. And when we were sat down once, and I've kept it, I've got it in a drawer here. We were just talking like this, and she gasped and looked down, and she went, "Oh my God." And I went, and she was unflappable, usually sort of like really. And I said, "What is it?" And she said, "It's somebody's skull." And I looked down, and it wasn't. It was a piece of gourd, you know, the gourd thing.
Yeah.
But the fact that she could think that, and actually where we'd sat, she had found somebody's knuckle. And one of the worst things that I remember, because I used to go off on my own and take photos. I took loads of photographs. And I was in this classroom where there'd been a massacre. And my foot was scraping along the floor. And I thought, oh, I've got a stone stuck in my boot, you know. So I sat down and I turned the boot round, and there were several teeth that I'd stood on. They were children's teeth.
Oh, Lord.
It was, and when I look back on it now, if it hadn't been for Esther, who took us on this journey, I think I would have gone a bit madder than I did. She was an incredible woman. And what I was telling you about earlier, that sometimes you just didn't want to hear people's stories because each one was worse than the one before. After we left, she now lives in Germany. She went back to Germany and she went deaf. And it was, I think her body's saying, "No more, you don't listen anymore. Otherwise, you will seriously damage yourself." So she lost her hearing for about 3 months. And that sort of degree of suffering and extremity is just something you're just not used to, you know. So thank goodness she was there, you know, because she had tremendous hope for people, even despite what had happened to her family and to other people. And
it's astonishing that your first instinct on seeing something shaped like that would be to think it was a skull.
Yeah, incredible.
And you were so used to it that that was the thing that occurred to you.
Yeah.
That's a horrifying thought, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, she was an incredible woman. Do you remember the film Hotel Rwanda?
Mm.
Well, he's since been discredited. And I remember when the film came out, I chatted to Esther a bit about it. And she was very quiet about him because he's sort of hailed as this hero who saved a lot of people. He did save some people, but he also did some awful things, you know. And Esther told me about when she was in one of the... It's funny, I'm not superstitious, but in this hotel where that film is set, Hotel Colleen, the second floor has got this feeling about it. And I said to Esther, I said, there's something about that floor. And she said, that was the floor where, she said, I had a room there. And we were 12 to a room. And the hotel owner came in with the local parish priest. And he came into the room and you could tell that he wanted to have this woman who was in the room. And he said, "You come with me." And Esther stood up and she said, "I've got two children here. She's the only one who can get them to be quiet. Would you mind not taking her?" So he sort of shamefaced left, but she saved her probably from being raped and maybe from being killed. And when you, it's like the... It's like the Spinal Tap thing. It puts things in too much fucking perspective, you know. Mm. It was a life-changing experience.
Did it affect your faith in people? Because you've always been a most positive man in the sense of, you know, things will be okay, you know, if we all just get on, things will sort themselves out. That's always been my attitude that I've got from you is that, you know, well, if we all just, you know, come on, We'll be okay. We'll be okay.
It was a bit of that. I'm afraid to say, and it probably happens to a lot of people who... I became a bit Bob Geldof when I came back. I wanted to do so much because I sort of, the widows that I'd met were women who had survived the genocide, and they were in the middle of the world in this tiny village. And for me, it's they represented the pilot light of humanity, that if they could keep going after everything that had happened to them, then humanity would be all right. And I hung on to that, you know, as long as they were alive, and that's why doing stuff for Comic Relief was so important, I felt I had to do it, you know. And a lot of good did happen, you know, and continues to happen. I mean, Comic Relief is an amazing thing,
isn't it?
I have put Richard Curtis in my I couldn't work out, you were very generous in saying that I looked to the positive side. And when I first thought about this, I was thinking, I can't think of anything negative, you know, to put in the time capsule that I want to be bury for good. But in the end, I came up with a huge list. And on that list is Richard Curtis.
For constantly asking you to do things.
No, because I went up for Love Actually. I did the table read for Love Actually. And it was really funny because at half time we're all saying, gosh, this is good, isn't it? It's really, and all these fantastic people, Chris Marshall and Bill Nye and Emma Thompson and Martin McCutcheon, all these fantastic people. And I said, yeah, it's going to be funny, isn't it? Because he's going to make the film and none of us are going to be in it. Well, I was the only one who wasn't in it in the end.
Oh, no. So, oh my God!
So for a long time, Richard Curtis was on my sort of hate list.
I auditioned for that film, and I completely blew it. Do you know how I blew it at the end of it? Because I'd known Richard for a long time, so it was strange to be not relaxed with him.
Yes,
you know, to be thinking I'm auditioning. So when it came to the end, they said, "So is there anything you want to ask or say about the script or any thoughts?" And I said, "Yeah, I did have a think actually. Do you know what? I mean, I really like the part I'm going for. I think it'd be fun to do, but I think I'd be much better as a prime minister." And Richard got the joke. He said, "Yeah, well, sadly, Mike, we're contractually obliged to use this bloke called Hugh Grant. I mean, I don't know why we do it." I said, "Oh, well, never mind, next time." But they obviously thought I was a nutter. I must have left the room. They went, "There's no way we're having that bloke in the film."
Well, it's funny. I don't mind losing out to people who are good.
No.
And I did lose out to somebody who was good, so I don't mind. And also, coming back to the thing about encouragement and support of your family and your friends, and because you need, as an actor, you need it, because you're going to go through some bad times. But when my son realised that I was quite upset, because when we watched it first, I was sort of like, and he went, "Well, don't worry, Dad, it's a shit film."
That's a perfect thing to say.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
But it's funny, isn't it? And you must have experienced it too, when it's all right when people in the business sort of that you don't know don't choose you. But when it's somebody you know, it feels a bit more personal, you know.
I would be really concerned about calling a friend, somebody who really was a friend.
Yeah. But one of the things I have learned is that whether you're a friend or unknown, you often get treated badly. I think if I was in somebody's position of, say, employing a mate, I think I'd have the bottle to phone them up and say, "Listen, you're great. I know you're great, but it just hasn't worked out because of certain things. I'm really sorry." Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that the hurt is any less from the actor, but it's just a bit more decent, isn't it?
Yes.
Because the same happened with Ben Elton. I went up for a play in the West End, Silly Cow, it was called, I think.
And John French did.
Yeah. And, you know, I've known Ben for ages.
Since university.
Yeah. And my son had just been born. And so a sort of run in the West End would just be really good because it'd be in London, you know. And I came auditioned and I just didn't hear. And then literally 15 years later, I bump into Ben Elton in a hotel. In your neck of woods, it was in...
Tunbridge Wells.
Yeah, it was in Tunbridge Wells. He was doing a stand-up tour. And anyway, I saw him in the bar and people were saying, there's Ben Elton there. And so I went up, you know, big cuddles and things like that. He's lovely, you know. Mm. And I said, Ben, I'm going to say something now, but I don't want you to apologise because I'm over it, but I want to get it off my chest. I said, years and years ago, my son had just been born. I went up for a play in the West End. I don't mind not getting jobs, but nobody told me anything. So when it opened and closed, I presumed I hadn't got it. But nobody had informed me. And he went, oh, I'm so sorry. I said, Ben, I don't want apologies, you know.
But no, it rarely happens. It's very strange how the whole process of, if somebody's interested in you for a part, they will be extremely interested and kind and generous. And the moment they decide they don't want you again, it's as if you've disappeared. Yes. And that's a sort of a traditional thing in acting, the theatre. Yep. And we get used to it. It really comes home to you, I think, if you ever do anything. I once auditioned with my family. My agent said, they're looking for a family.
Wow.
So we went and auditioned together. And you know my wife, and you know that she's probably the last person in the world who would want to do something like that. I bribed her into it, I think. I forced her into it by first of all telling the children that there'd be a lot of money involved in it. And they were saying, you've got to do it, Mum, you've got to do it. So she went, oh, for God's sake. We went along for this thing, and the people were so rude. But that's what I thought at the time. Thinking back on it, I thought, oh, no, actually, that's what always happens.
Yeah.
They treat you like a piece of meat.
I had a similar one when Matty was quite young. This job came up and they needed a young boy, and a casting director said, would Matty go up for it? And he was quite shy. And so I calmed him down. We went to the... All the time I'm going, it's 2 weeks in the Caribbean. It's all this dosh, you know. So you're sort of like going like that, but trying to sort of go, you know, Matty, we're just going here. We're just going, you just be nice to the nice man. And he had this thing about beards. And we walk in and the director with the beard goes, Gucci, Gucci, Goo. Well, he started crying. He hadn't cried in months. And he started... And I just went, I'm out. I'm sorry. I'm really, really sorry.
Yeah.
So we, you know, we left, but...
But yeah, you're right to, you know, if anybody's listening who's thinking of doing it, it's not a forgiving profession. If you don't get it, you don't get it, and that's it, you're gone. And if people don't come after you and say, oh, I'm so sorry, very rarely does that happen.
You're right, mainly the business is not civil. No. You know, they tried to do this thing a while back where if you went to audition in 2 weeks, the casting director had to tell you, yes or no. But they don't, because if on the first day the person they've chosen they find out has a limp, then they go, right, oh, I better get down. Hang on, Bradley, he hasn't got a limp. Let's get him back in. So they don't dare say you're out of it because they're covering rear ends, you know.
You're right. But at the same time, it does have these magical things about it. So the idea of you after all those years going back to the Royal Exchange.
Yeah.
Just wonderful.
And one of the other really weird things is that the first time I appeared on that stage was with Vanessa Redgrave in Lady from the Sea, directed by Michael Elliott, whose daughter is a great theatre director. He was an amazing theatre director. And they flooded the stage. And what was really, really odd in this production that I'd started to do last year, they flooded the stage. I couldn't believe it. I was going, the design came out and I went, you're flooding the stage. She said, yeah. I started laughing and they went, why? And I went, no, it's just coming back full circle.
Yeah, you know? You always flood the stage.
And they had exactly the same problems as Lady from the Sea had. Number one, it leaked. And number two, it smelled.
And they'd not learned all those years before.
It was a great place to work. And I once did the family reunion when Edward Fox was in it. And, it's in the round. And he used to come in from the outside like that and go around. And people used to lean over the balconies to see him coming on. And you knew when he came on because this was a shower of programmes. People just knocked their programmes off into them. And I used to sit in the... one of the cast members passed on, sadly, and then so they had an elder actress taking over. And I was prompt. you know, making myself useful in the theatre. And so I sat there and I prompted her, and I had to do it on the first night. But she used to listen to what people were saying in the audience. And one of the lines, Avril Elgar, it was a sort of very pretentious T.S. Eliot play, The Family Reunion. And one of the lines is, Avril Elgar looks up and says, he is a doer. We are but watchers and waiters. And somebody in the audience went, oh, they're Weight Watchers. It was a great place to work.
Brilliant. So what have we put in the time capsule so far? We put in the review from Philip Lawrence.
That's right, which is support and encouragement.
And then we've also put in going back to the Royal Exchange. Was
it? Well, I hadn't included. That was a sort of sidetrack. The next thing I wanted to put in was Rick Mayall's underpants.
You see, typical Bradley. And just when we need to take a short ad break. But we'll be back with Rick Mayall's underpants as quickly as we can. Washed and ironed, I imagine.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome back to Paul Bradley, but most importantly, to a detailed look at the underpants of the much-missed and still much-loved Rick Mayall.
The next thing I wanted to put in was Rick Mayall's underpants.
Wouldn't we all?
Because he used to have a pair of purple underpants, which were his lucky underpants. And he always used to wear them on stage and things like that. Because one of the things you need as an actor starting out is luck. And I mean, Rick and I were great friends at university. And I wrote a show with John Otway, Verbal Diary, it was called. And we needed some money to do the set. We had a very clever concept for the set. The set was, it was a diary that opened up like that. And it had a 2D set. So like one of the sets was a pub and you'd have, there'd be a full pint there like that. And you'd drink like that and turn it over and it'd be empty. So it was little jokes like that. But we didn't have any money. So I went to Rick and I said, is there any chance you could lend us some money? I said, and he said, yeah, of course. And he said, just give me back what I've given to you. He said, because I know you're not going to make any money. I mean, we weren't. It was to sort of, I got loads of work from it. It was a brilliant thing to do because casting directors came to see it. I got loads of stuff from it. And sometimes you have to reinvent yourself, you know, don't you, in the business. So that's what I did. And so I'd like to put Rick's underpants in because they signify luck. And then I'd like to put my band, the Kippers, in as well. And they're sort of linked because Rick came to see the band and he really liked it because they're on the lines of the Bonzos. And we really used to like the Bonzos and things. And anyway, so I do this song in it. In fact, I've got some here.
How long have you been doing the Kippers?
It's about 30 years.
Yeah.
Years and years.
And also Kippers with an H.
Yeah, silent H in front, because it's a long story, but there's a band called the Copper Family, which are a real folk band, and there's a band that takes the piss out of them called the Kipper Family, that are known as the Kippers. So because our music's sort of Eastern European-ish, we stuck a small H in front, which Facebook won't let you do. But anyway, Rick came to see the show, and one of the songs we did, I wasn't involved in. I play guitar and sing at it. The Guardian said, I sing like a lorry driver, which I take as a compliment. But one of the tunes that I wasn't in, I had some sellotape to post up a set list on the microphone stand. And while they were doing their song, I thought, hang on, this might work. So I started doing this and wrapping it around my head. Anyway, Rick came to it and he said, I love that. And 3 months later, he says, do you want to be in an episode of Bottom? And I said, I'd love to. So I played this burglar. I come in, I get caught, and I get sellotaped to the ceiling. Rick never, you know, he was like a lot of comedians. They're looking for material the whole time because, of course, comedy eats material.
Yeah.
And I remember Stephen, who writes all the music for the Kippers, and who subsequently got a Oscar for writing the music for Shakespeare in Love. We've been mates for years as well. And the Pogues drummer is in our band as well. Mm. And Shane McGowan, I bumped into him at this gig, and I'd met him a few times, you know. And I met him at this Dr. John gig at Town and Country. And he sort of sat there drinking away. And he said, Paul, how are the Kippers doing? I said, yeah, we're doing great. We're doing great. And he said, I must come and see you sometime. I said, Shane, you've seen us. And he said, did I like you? But it was funny because when I left EastEnders, one of the main writers, Tony Jordan, he came to see a Kippers gig, and he invited us all around to his house. It was in Flitwick. Do you know Flitwick? It's up the M1, Junction 13, I think.
I don't know it, but I've seen the sign.
We did a hall there, and I think the audience was Tony Jordan and his family and a dog. And after the gig, Tony said, oh, come back to the house. So we came back to the house, and he got me in a corner. He said, and I'd left EastEnders about 6 months ago. He said, come back. I've got this really great story, you know. And he was one of the best story writers, and, you know, did Death in Paradise and Life on Mars. Anyway, we're there at his party, and he was trying to get me to come back. And then he said, look, there's an Oscar winner over there. There's a Pogue over there, and I'm fucking talking to you. Yeah, so I'd like to put the Kippers in, because I've never been brave enough to do stand-up, but it's the nearest I get to doing stand-up, because I can do banter with the rest of the band. And it's a bit like being, although I play guitar in the band, it's a bit like being a passenger in a Rolls Royce. They're all such good musicians that I think they make me look good.
I mean, I know you only do it for the money.
Absolutely, yeah. But we've stopped paying to do gigs now, so...
Oh, brilliant. I wonder where Rick's underpants are. They should be in a museum of comedy.
Yeah, they should be, yeah.
One of the greats, absolutely, without doubt, one of the greats.
He was great. He was a lovely man. We were in the same digs at university in the first year, and he was on the ground floor just above the bar, strangely enough, and I was on the 17th floor. And we used to have this code. I used to flash three times to fancy going for a pint, and if he flashed three back, we'd go for a pint. But we used to do this thing at university where on a Monday night, you could put on whatever you wanted. They gave you a small budget. They gave you about £5. So people did bits of Beckett. And anyway, Rick and Aid had themselves sewed into these pink duvet covers and came on stage and started doing this hilarious dialogue, which you could just about hear. But on the Tuesday after the Monday night group, you had to not justify, but sort of like say what people could ask you questions and say, well, that was a very interesting adaptation of Beckett, why did you have the tree as a naked man weeing, which is in fact what somebody did do. And anyway, so it came to Rinconade, and the tutor said, well, you know, that was very, very funny. But what were you? And Rick said, oh, didn't you get it? We were God's bollocks. Oh, God. And it was sort of like side-splitting, you know. And
yeah.
We were good mates. We kept up being mates, but his illness changed him an awful lot, you know.
Yeah, yeah, after it hit his head.
Yeah. But I'm still in touch with Aid, and he's good at everything. But he's got pissed off because nobody's ever asked him to be on Desert Island Discs. So what he's going to do is his own live show, where he chooses six records or so, but he plays them himself. Brilliant idea.
Brilliant idea, yeah.
It's funny when you're, I don't know whether you found it, because you were surrounded at university with people who went on to do loads of really good stuff. Mm. But when you're there, it becomes a bit normal, doesn't it? You sort of go, well, everyone must be having these genius comics in their midst, you know. So,
yeah.
And also when you're young and at university, you get terribly, I don't know, maybe it's just me, but you sort of think, oh, I'm better than that, you know.
Yeah. As a lesson for anybody young listening, is absolutely. I do remember the first Edinburgh I went up to, having never done any review or comedy sketch stuff or anything. And they said, oh, this fellow from last year is going to come in and sort of go through some of the sketches with us. And he's written most of them, actually. And so he's going to sort of like help direct it. And I thought,
yeah.
I don't need directing. I know what I've read it. I understand what it is. I don't need somebody to tell me what it means. I know what it means. And of course, in walked Richard Curtis. And I think I probably on the first meeting spent the whole time going, yeah, yeah, sure, yeah, whatever.
In some ways, you've got to, haven't you? You've got to be strong in your own voice.
Got to be that bold, I think.
And yes. You can look back and say, oh, God, I was a toss-up. But, I mean, sometimes you often think as an actor, your only choice is to say no, mm-hmm. that if somebody offers you something, because it's very rarely that what you want to do appears straight away, unless you're mm-hmm. terribly lucky. I mean, it's funny because I remember I had doubts about doing EastEnders, not out of any snobbishness, but because it wasn't how I saw my career going. I sort of thought, well, I'll do sort of small comedy parts and then maybe get character roles on telly. And I mean, you've stolen my career that I really wanted. And also Jim Broadbent. You know, I look at someone and I go, oh, I could do that. Maybe I couldn't. And I remember going to Rick and saying, I've been offered, you know, a year's contract at, because I start off with four episodes, and then a few months later they said, do you want to come back? And anyway, he said, do it. He said, get your fame and then you'll be able to choose.
Yes.
And which did happen. It opens as many doors as it closes, I think, because you get known for one thing. But so I was known for one thing for quite a long while. Didn't work for a bit. Then started up and got known for another one thing when I joined Holby.
But are you right about that thing about being bold when you're young? I mean, when you think about some of the ridiculous ideas that we came up with when we were young, my favourite thing we ever came up with was when the people at Granada Television said to us, can you come up with a way of filling nighttime television? And we came up with, I don't even remember what the idea was. Do you remember?
No.
We came up with a programme called The Mail Room, where we would go from the bar when it shut, and we would go to the mailroom where the delivery of all the unsolicited scripts was made at about 1 o'clock in the morning, and we were going to open them and read them.
Yeah.
And that's how we intended to fill nighttime television, with us sitting there drunkenly reading through scripts. And we actually took the idea to David Lindemann and said, what do you think? And he was interested.
Yeah.
He said, do me a pilot.
Blimey.
I know.
I mean, that was a great time, wasn't it, at Granada?
Yeah. Great time.
We did some really good stuff. But I was very, I don't know if you remember, I was very political in those days. I was a member of the Socialist Workers' Party, and I was in a co-op, and they came to us and said, do you want to do a kids' program? So we came up with Bradley, didn't we?
Mm.
So we sort of devised it, and we wrote one together. And I remember talking to the producer and saying, God, we've got a fantastic cast here. You know, we've got Sheila Hancock. We've got...
Mark Hughes.
Mark Hughes.
Played you, didn't he?
Yeah. Apparently, people used to shout out my name when he appeared on the football pitch. But so I was saying, we've got these fantastic people. We've got a fantastic cast, you know. And he said, yeah, when you came in so low, we thought... I remember talking to my co-op and saying, you know, want some good money here.
It's a series called Bradley, and I play the lead in it.
Yeah. And I remember he said that the bloke who did my negotiation said, the casting director said, now don't be silly here. And he said, but I thought I would be. So my fee for the BBC, I think, was 900 per episode. Mm. And he said, so I asked them for a grand. And she straight away said, yes. I don't know, you were probably on $7,000 an episode.
I without doubt got paid more than you, yes.
Yeah, that's the thing, though. If you don't know, it's like that, what's the play where if you drink a draught of wine and you don't see the poisonous animal that's in it, then you don't... If you see it, you're scared. But if you don't, you're... I don't know if that refers to anything at all.
All right, look, I'm going to put Rick Mayo's purple underpants into the time capsule.
Because they represent luck.
And the kippers for... What does that represent?
The kippers represent...
Enjoyment.
Enjoyment and delight. That's all it's about. I remember asking Stephen, who's a brilliantly eccentric musician, and after a while I said, what is the kippers? What is it about? And he said, I don't know, he said, but I'm hoping that we're going to play at each other's funerals. And I said, well, in the long run, that's not going to be possible, is
it? No, just a solo.
And it's sort of like an anti-fame thing. It's one of the real pleasures. I learned an awful lot watching musicians, because what they do is, because there's quite a few solos, and somebody will do a solo and that will set the bar. Mm. And without being... You know, they're not trying to outdo each other. They go, okay, that's the bar. I'm going up there. And the next one goes up there. Mm. So by the end of the gig, they're sort of like really going for it, you know. And there's something about that being lost in music while you're playing it, and certainly in a band, there's no feeling like it. No. You sort of like, I'm learning the Celtic... I'm learning the Celtic ukulele now. But that's helped me through lockdown.
Yeah, just about. All right, so you've got two more things to put into the time capsule, Paulie.
I'm going to put an Irish pub in.
Oh, I don't blame you.
Because we've got a place in Ireland, in West Cork, in a place called Ardgroom. And actually, when we were going there a while ago with a friend of mine from New Zealand, we stopped in Kenmare in this posh hotel, and the woman who came to bring us a breakfast said, so, no, where are you going? I said, we're going to Ardgroom. She said, why would you go there? It's one of the most beautiful places in the world, and we're very lucky to... We're a field away from the sea. We're 5 minutes away from the nearest neighbour. It's a very small cottage. My mum, when she died, left a bit of money, and my parents are Irish, and I've always had that connection. Mm. And we're amazingly lucky to go there. And there's one pub in the town, the village inn. There's another pub on the way in Kenmare, which is the bigger town. And I was outside this pub, and this man came up to me, and he said, are you going in? And I said, do you know, I might. And he said, he's looking at the menu, the fish menu outside. And he said, can you tell them they've spelt mussels wrong? Only in Ireland, you know.
Only in Ireland. The most wonderfully funny things, inadvertently, certainly in that area, you will have noticed it on the roads. On English roads, when you're driving along and you're coming to a bend, it says slow. And in Ireland, it says slow. And then a little bit further on, it says slower.
Yeah, that's right. It's like they're watching you.
Slow. Go now, slower. Slower now. That's not slow. And I thought, it's such a knowledge of humanity.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
There's a pub in Kenmare It's on the main drag, but it's not a tourist place. There's a lot of diddly-dee tourist music there, but this pub called Crowley's is sort of like you get brilliant musicians in there. Mm. And the last time we went there, there was a sign on the door and it said, we open at 6-ish.
Perfect. I stayed in a hotel in Galway where it had a notice in the foyer that said, the hotel bar will be closed to non-residents between 4 and 5 in the morning. And then it said, we apologise for the inconvenience. Oh, beautiful.
You know, the Angelus, when they play the Angelus, they're not allowed to serve, because being a Catholic country. Mm. So you hear the Angelus and they say prayers, and there's this story about this Englishman going to a pub in Dublin, and he says, "I'll have a pint of Guinness." He said, "Oh God, I'm really sorry, sir. It's the Angelus." He said, "We would have to wait for an hour," and so it wasn't long to wait. So the bloke sat down, and the barman comes over and says, "You look so miserable there. Will you have one while you wait?"
That's exactly the sort of generosity of it. Very funny. So is it the pub in the village near to your cottage that you want to put in?
Yes, it would have to be. I went there a couple of years ago, and I usually do Dry January, and we happened to be over there, and I came into the pub, and she said, "Pint of Guinness." And I said, "No, I'll have a Coke." She said, "What? Why?" I said, "I'm doing Dry January." And she said, "Sure, that'll do you no good."
That's the sort of pub you want to put into a time capsule. Brilliant.
I was in Steve McFadden, actually. He was over that way. He does a lot of fishing. Mm-hmm. And he said, "Oh, you, Paul, you got a place over in West Cork. Are you over there now?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Well, advise us. Where can we go?" I said, "Right. We're in what's called the Bearer Peninsula. Mm. And there's a pass called Healy Pass. And it's one of the most amazing views I've ever seen. It's fantastic. If you go one way, the view is better." So I said, "Steve, you've got to do Healy's Pass because it's amazing, you know." He said, you go over Healy Pass and you go through an area called Laura and you come to Kilmacalogue Harbour. And I know you like your mussels, the fresh mussels there in a harbour pub. You'll love it. Anyway, so didn't hear anything from him. And then a week later, he phones up and he said, "I went to that pub." And I went, "All right." And you can never tell with Steve whether he's going to cuddle you or nut you. And anyway, I said, "Kilmacalogue." And he said, "Yeah." And I said, "Did you have a good time?" He went quiet and he went, "I had the fucking best time of my life." He sat down there, four of us. We have mussels, chips, 2 pints each. We sat down there. I go in to settle up. And she says, "No charge." I went, "What?" She said, "You've brought so much pleasure to people. I'm not charging you." Oh. He said, "I couldn't believe it."
Ah, how lovely.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I don't blame you. We'll definitely put that pub into the time capsule.
I think we've done 4.
Yeah.
Well, the last one is very easy. It's just a list. I couldn't think of anything specific that I wanted to bury and not, you know, the negative thing. So I just wrote a list. Marmite, Donald Trump, Brexit, directors who can't direct, late scripts, bad scripts, Vodafone customer services, the National Lottery, I never win, the All Blacks for always winning, Richard Curtis for not casting me in Love Actually, Love Actually the film, actors who don't learn their lines, The Fiddler's Three, which is just before you're going for a take, the makeup, wardrobe and sound come up and start fiddling with you. And you're trying to get ready in your head and they're going like that. And then there's theatre reviewers who slagged me off or never mentioned me. Dogs. That's a controversial one. Dogs.
Yeah. Or just all dogs.
Well, I was going to have certain breeds and then I thought, no, fuck it, put all the dogs in there.
Your time capsule, you can put them in if you like.
That's right, because last year when we were doing the exchange, I got attacked by dogs and bitten on the arse. And And this is a really weird thing, you know, inexplicable. There is a God up there. In fact, it's an anagram of dog. But I got attacked by these dogs. And I was going into the road. I was shouting, saying, help, help. And I put my hand out like that. I'm not kidding you. And it was a white van. And then I looked down and it was police dog control unit.
Wow.
So I thought, it's their dogs, you know. But it wasn't. They would just happen to be passing. And they came and placated the dogs, took them away from me. But I'm still going to, you know.
Put them in.
I mean, it's a sort of like endless list, really. But bad location food. And then I sort of ended with Michael Fenton Stevens.
Yeah, quite.
Because... He's always nicked the jobs that I've always wanted.
You could have had them. I wouldn't have minded.
I think I should interview you for this.
Well, somebody will do one day.
Yeah.
Why not?
But that's it. You can do your shopping now.
it's always lovely to see you, Paul.
Yeah.
Really lovely.
You have been listening to My Time Capsule with me, Mike Fenton-Stevens, and my guest, Paul Bradley. I really did have to go shopping, which is a shame, because I could have talked to Paul all day. Another time, maybe. Probably in the pub. Anyway, if you enjoyed this podcast, then please subscribe to it on the podcast provider of your choice. Ours is Acast. Oh, and do rate the show and maybe leave a small review. Thanks very much. You can follow me or My Time Capsule on Twitter and things like that. And you can listen to the theme tune on Spotify. In fact, you can download it. The composer Past the Peas music will be delighted. This was a Cast-Off production. The producer was John Fenton Stevens. Right, much thanks for your support for this podcast. Do tell your friends. I mean, where else would you get a man at the end of a podcast filling time by seeing if, like Paul and his band the Kippers with a silent H, I can play the sellotape. Right, let's see, shall we? Yeah, there you go. Clear evidence that playing sticky tape is not as easy as it looks. So do go and see Paul's band the next time you see them advertised and admire his skill. Keep very well. Bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.